welcome to Red Pro Screenings, episode 102. I'm your host, and with me is my regular host, Jackson.
Hello, movies.
And Destiny.
Films.
Ah, the fight between movies and films begins now. Which wins?
I'm going to start calling them pictures, and everyone's going to get really pissed off at me.
Flicks. I'm calling them flicks.
I'd rather you call them pictures than flicks.
What's wrong with flicks?
It's just so, like, that's something Vince Vaughn would call them.
You mean it's 90s? You mean it's so 90s?
It's not 90s. I assume flicks is because of the flickering of a projector, right? It doesn't really make sense now, but I assume that's why they're called flicks.
I assume as well.
I assume that's where the slang comes from, but as like a thing, like, oh, check out these flicks, I would imagine some cool 90s
look,
slang.
All of these are better than Kino, is what I gotta say. You know? That might be the worst one.
Does anyone call it that?
Yes, Destiny's
online.
No,
no one calls it that. Not in that way.
I've never heard anyone call a film a Kino, like in earnest.
No one calls it a Kino. It's more like cinema. When you said like, oh, this movie is fucking cinema, then that will be how they'll use Kino, as opposed to saying like, I've been watching Kino.
Well, I'm just saying we could degrade the language further by people just using. I'm just gonna go watch Kino.
I guess they do occasionally use that for movies, but usually it's used for cartoons for 5-year-olds.
Yes. Anyway, Jackson, I don't actually know your answer to this. What have you watched?
I watched Godzilla Raids Again, the second Godzilla movie.
Oh, right. God, I felt like it was like 8 months ago.
It was earlier in the cycle, but I was technically between podcasts. Yeah. And I quite liked it. I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it.
It's good.
Considering I've heard it's like the shitty, empty sequel to Godzilla they made in 6 months. And like it is.
Yeah, but it's really good.
It's a good one. I'm glad that like it took literally 6 months into making Godzilla to have our first The JSDF Will Save Everyone from Godzilla movie.
Yeah. The second time they'll just handle it.
I do really like the effect of that. It's like, you know, in the first movie, right, Godzilla is the like... reckoning for humanity's sins, for like the atomic sins of mankind, for Japan's warring stature and imperial power, you know, doing a lot
but
of
also
things
specifically like the way in which Japan itself cannot deal with the nuclear powers, i.e. America, just
right,
get
yes.
steamrolled.
So there's like a lot of, but there's like, it's like both guilt and also like, this is the new world and also this is the imperial like submission we've had like a decade ago, right? There's a lot of things, a lot of thematic weight, I would say, in the movie Godzilla, famously, right? Famous movie, dealing with a lot of things, the battle of ideas. Godzilla Raids Again is about when there's a guy that's fucking annoying. Like the speed with which something that has portent and like thematic importance just becomes a thing that you have to deal with, it's so good to me. Like, it's just, oh, right, Godzilla's happening. I guess he does represent all these things, but we still have to deal with the giant fucking lizard showing up every two years.
Yeah.
That's good. I just like it. Like, the way in which an icon becomes, like, actually the thing you have to deal with, which is a giant lizard that attacks every so often. And I love the whole sequence with the lights and the way they're, like, leading Godzilla off with the light situation and the way that breaks bad. And then they have the whole fight with the guy breaking the castle. That's a great iconic fight.
Yes.
The human stuff is like not exceptional, but totally fine. You know, I was pleasantly surprised by what I was told was like, oh, this is the first bad Godzilla movie. It's totally fine.
They're worse. I haven't even seen all Godzilla movies. I can tell you there are worse Godzilla movies than that one.
Oh, I bet there's worse Godzilla movies. If anything, it makes me sad. I guess America's doing this because, like, you know, Shin Godzilla happened and Godzilla Minus One happened, which I haven't seen, but I know both those movies deeply thematically invested with their big ideas, and everyone's posting about Minus One like it's the same way. And if they made them every 18 months, they would have to get over that occasionally and just make a movie about a big lizard sometimes. But I think that's what America's doing.
Yeah. I saw a picture of King Kong from the new one, and he's got like a fucking mecha arm. I was like, when did this happen?
Yeah, see, exactly. You need the balance. You need your deep and portent. This is about the ideas of the last warring century Godzilla movies. But you also need a movie where there's a guy in a suit, and well, I guess it's CGI now, but where it's just a fun lizard movie.
Yeah.
The dichotomy of Godzilla there.
Godzilla's new mode is based on the Kaioken, because the director's like, I really like him when Goku does the Kaioken. I was like, fuck yeah, you do, everybody does.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Fucking Godzilla's based on the Kaioken.
No, he's got a new, he's got a new purple red, like atomic overpower move or whatever in the new movie. And apparently it's based on the Kaioken, like exclusively.
Well, it's going to get really overpowered, like, as soon as the Saiyans show up. No one's going to use it again.
Well, yeah, I mean, does it tear up all his muscles every time he uses it, so Godzilla's got to, like, rest? It's like, oh, he really needs a truck-sized senzu bean every time he does it.
King Kong throwing, like, a building like a senzu bean to Godzilla.
Oh, fuck yes, let's go. It's just a food truck that's called senzu bean.
It just
yes.
says senzu bean on the
side.
Yes.
You know what? Adam Wingard would do something that stupid.
Oh, I wish. I wish that were true. I don't think it's true, but I wish that were true.
I mean, he's not doing that literally, but I would say that's the ballpark he plays in these movies. But yeah, that's me. Just watch the Godzilla movie.
Just one? Good. Man.
Well, I've been doing other stuff.
I would say the movies are not now more than ever. Less than ever.
I watched 3 hours of fucking Kingdom of Heaven, if you must know.
Oh, I'm doing that so, after this. That's my tonight thing.
If you can give me shit for that, that's one thing, but we have another podcast.
Our blockbusters on Kingdom of Heaven will be out later this week. I don't actually know what day yet, because we're kind of... Normally that's a Monday podcast, but this is a Monday podcast, and Alf's a Tuesday podcast, and there's no Gundam this week, so it'll probably be a Wednesday or Thursday podcast.
I assume it'll go in the Gundam slot. That makes sense to me.
But look forward to that. It's patreon.com/normapping for $5. I hope it's good.
Yeah.
Did you like it?
It's okay.
All right. Destiny, what you got?
I watched two movies. I can't remember if I talked about this movie last time. So if I talked about Immaculate last time, I'm sorry.
You asked before and I was like, I'm pretty sure you did, but I just talked to you a lot. So it's impossible for me to tell.
Well, I saw it, and it was good. It was very spooky, very lurky, lots of shadows, nun goes to convent.
This is not helping me know if you've talked about it before.
This is like half the movies Destiny goes to see,
Destiny watched a spooky movie and enjoyed it? Oh, I don't know if that happened in the last podcast or not. Oh, no.
Right, yeah, exactly. But, yeah, no, this movie is about the ultimate unwanted pregnancy, and it is a good time. Just real spooky. I really liked, what's her name? Sydney Sweeney.
Yes.
I think the first thing I've ever seen her in, and yeah, she's really good in it. It's a fucked up movie. Fucked up movie about how fucked up Catholicism is. The end. I also watched a documentary called Becoming Nobody about Ram Dass and his whole... All of his,
would you describe to the audience who probably don't know who Ram Dass is?
Oh, sure. Ram Dass was one of the white hippies who, like, took LSD with Timothy Leary in the 60s and then was like, oh, I want to feel like this all the time. And everybody was like, well, you should go to India and get a guru. And he did. And it, like, completely warped his life. And he ended up coming back to the States and doing all these teachings and sort of bridging Eastern religion with Western philosophy and psychology. And this movie is pretty much like a bunch of just different teachings all sort of culminating. And like he had a stroke at the end of his life. He died in 2019 or 2020, I think. But so like it is a biography about his life, but it's also about his teachings, and then it sort of leads up to like him sort of talking about his own mortality because he knows it's coming, and it was made right before he died, so it's a really good movie. It's really sad, not sad, but like pretty inspiring, you know, like one of those. I really liked it, but yeah, those are the only two movies I watched.
All right. Gosh. So I watched all three Lizzie Borden movies on the Criterion Channel this month. Who is a feminist filmmaker who worked mostly in the 80s. She doesn't really do movies anymore. But those movies are Regrouping from 76 and Born in Flames from 83 and Working Girls from 86. She did a couple more movies, but like these are the ones that are like, those ones had like a bunch of studio interference. And so these are the ones that she like still claims, I guess. They're all really good. Regrouping is kind of a pseudo documentary about like it's documenting a like feminist group enclave's a little too strong group, just navigating their space. But it starts with like, they're all going to work on this film together to show what it's like to be a feminist in New York in the 70s. And unlike the patriarchal, there's one director dictating the reality of a film. We're all going to like do it together, but she's still the one shooting the movie. So it turns out breaking that way anyway, because that's what happens when you have a director. And also everyone is just like, one of their members died before the movie started, and they're all really hung up on this woman. And then there's just a lot of infighting about like what counts as being a lesbian, and shit that still goes on. Nothing's changed discourse wise. It's really good. For a long time, she didn't air it because she was like, this is like very embarrassing that we tried to make this thing and just ended up like kind of showing our asses. But I think that's what's good about it. All these movies are like under, I think the longest one is Working Girls at like 90 minutes, but this is like a 70 something minute movie. It's really good. And then Born in Flames is the one that I need everybody to watch. It's from 1983. And it's set in a near future New York City where the America is celebrating it's the 10th anniversary of the revolution when a Democrat socialist government took over and everything entered a, you know, Dem-Sosh Wonderland. And by that, it mean that inflation is runaway and there's no fucking jobs. Everyone's on like a workfare program. Like instead of welfare, it's workfare where everyone gets jobs. But like there's like a movement of like people, like men want, are like, we don't get jobs. All the women are taking our jobs. So there's like a progressive, like, oh, we're giving the jobs to black men, but the sidelining women. And it's about two groups of women who run these underground radio stations, one who's black and one who's white, forming a sort of like intersectional resistance movement. It's really fucking good is the thing. It's like Battle of Algiers, but like near future.
Okay.
I really loved it. It's like a little earnest about its preachiness in exactly the way a no wave early 80s movie can be. I think that's a plus, not a minus. I liked it a lot. Just extremely like aware of the fact that like the good policies, if they are not representational and if they're still dictated by capitalism, will not save us. Right.
Right.
And I liked it a lot. And then Working Girls is about an afternoon in like an upscale New York City brothel, where all of the sex workers are just kind of coming in and out and doing their shifts and meeting with the guys. And when they're not meeting with the guys, they're just kind of talking about like their lives. And then like the woman who runs the place comes in and she's like this awful yuppie who's like, you need to stop smoking and you need to stop having idle chatter and you need to like make sure you're wearing your stockings, just the worst. And they're all just like extremely over it. It's very like grounded in realism of women that she interviewed when she was making Born in Flames. It's really good. Just like its own like realism. Like, you know, the plots are really low-key, and there's no high drama. There's nobody gives a speech about how they were pushed into sex work through like, oh, I grew up and I was abused and I had to do this and run. It's just like people working a job every day and being bored and tired of it. And I liked it a lot. What else? I watched Once Upon a Time, Rome Open City, which I'll probably talk about when we talk about the movie, which is a 2006 television documentary about Rome Open City, that is pretty good.
A
lot of archival footage, a lot of interviews with the people who were around at the time, about the part where like all these guys like 3 years before were making propaganda films for, you know, the Italian government, go fight in World War II or whatever. And then they all kind of realized what the fuck they were doing and all broke a little differently. But like, not necessarily like, there's a bit where it's like, one of them is like, Rossellini wasn't a communist. Like he was interested in which like people, and he knew which way the wind was blowing and he made movies about that. And then one of the guys who like financed their movies was like the nephew of Mussolini. And he was eventually asked, like, did you know that there were so many like anarchists and leftists and working on it? He's like, no, I would have sent them all to jail if I'd known. We just made movies.
Wow.
It's really good. I liked it quite a bit. I recommend it. It's on YouTube. It's on Criterion if you're watching on Criterion. And then what else? I watched My Dad is 100 Years Old, which is a Guy Madden movie. Directed by Guy Madden, but it's written by Isabella Rossellini about her dad on his 100th birthday. And it's her confronting the memory of her dad, which is like depicted as just like, apparently he just like laid in bed all the time. Like that's what he did. When he wasn't working, he was laying in bed all the time. And it's just like this disembodied, like giant, like fat belly in bed, no shirt. Cause that's her memory of her dad. And then other famous directors, like Hitchcock and Chaplin and, Fellini, all played by Rossellini, coming in and like critiquing, critiquing his work and their opinions of his legacy. And it's very good. It's pretty short. It's like 17 minutes long. I've never seen a Guy Madden movie before, so it's all like super lo-fi and like a bunch of like feels very like spliced together, even though it's shot that way.
Does it look like a silent movie?
Yes, it's all black and white. It's all like David Lynch is doing like a cleaned up version of Guy Madden is the thing I realized.
Yeah, like Guy Madden really like that's his signature look. Yeah. And yeah, it's all really beautiful.
Like when Hitchcock is just in silhouette, like the Hitchcock Presents thing, like it's her clearly in like a stuffed shirt. So she has the big belly turned to the side, like silhouetted on a balcony.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. Just doing a fake Hitchcock voice. But obviously she has a like very thick Italian accent. So everyone talks with a very thick Italian accent. It's very good. I highly recommend it. And then just this morning I watched Jonathan Glazer's The Fall, which is like a 7-minute short movie, which was like nothing. This is the problem with short films. Sometimes you watch them, you're like, man, this is really interesting. My Dad is 100 Years Old is incredible. I highly recommend it. Jonathan Glazer's The Fall is like, all these guys are in masks and they grab this guy out of a tree and they hang him. But like the gallows they hang him from, like when the trapdoor drops, it's just like a pit into nothing. And they just watch the like noose, like run down the rope for like 5 minutes. And then once the noose is gone, they walk away and then it cuts to the inside of the shaft. And the guy's like climbing up the shaft because he like held onto the sides and that's it. That's a short film. I'm like, I don't know what that means. I don't know. Like, I mean, it's like nice looking, I guess. It's evocative, but like, what the fuck? Sometimes that's short films.
Yeah.
And like, you look at some of the interviews and it's like, or I was looking at the Letterboxd reviews as I like rated this and it was, people were like imparting this with lots of meaning in like a very like, you know, this is how you do it in school sort of way. And I'm like, you don't need to try this hard. It's fine. That's all.
That is what watching movies is, though.
Sometimes you just see people like really reaching for like, oh, this clearly represents society and the way society oppresses the individual, but the individual can persevere through like trickery and like, I'm like, yeah, I guess, but like, so to what end?
I mean, that's true. The fucked up guys have masks on. I get it. That's like
everyone has masks on. Even the guy they're hanging has masks on. I'm like, to what end? We all wear masks. Yeah, so.
Just ticking, like, well done, thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah, I'm like, this should have been a music video, at least have a good song behind it, right? Like, sometimes that's how I feel about abstract cinema. Sometimes I love it, but sometimes I go, this could have been a music video and I'd have it, I'd like it more.
Yeah, no, I feel the same way.
Yeah,
checking Letterboxd reviews is always a trap, though.
Yes.
There's one on the currently on the front page for Rome of the City, which reads, "A half-baked attempt to make me root for a communist partisan leader."
What? Stupid.
Oh, I'm gonna get into my communist-hating thing, but it's like a movie set in fucking 1945 Rome.
Yeah, very ridiculous.
Not you didn't really pay the attention right time to the movie.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, did you watch it at all?
These guys were ruthless Stalinists, often pretty much taking their orders from the Soviet Union. They're fighting the Nazis! You can't... we've all agreed that the one time it's gauche to do that, even for, like, good communist-hating liberals, to do that in the movies with the Nazis in. That you've got to keep your mouth shut at that
point. I kind of suspect a 1940s Italian guy is not an avowed Stalinist. I'm going to be honest with you.
I mean, also, that's, like... the Soviet Union were not like coordinating local resistance movements in Italy. They were all dying in the Second World War that was happening. Like, there was obviously international cooperation, but it wasn't like, oh, they're a Stalinist agent. Like, what are you fucking talking about? It's 1944. There's a war going on.
Anyway, I guess we should talk about the movie. Our movie this week is Rome, Open City, the 1949 neorealist war drama film directed by Roberto Rossellini, written by Sergio Amédée, Celeste Negrevil, and Federico Fellini. That guy. Yes, that Fellini.
yes.
This is apparently the first of his, like, then, like, dubbed after the fact, like, war trilogy with Paizan and Germany Year Zero. Famously, this movie was shot as Rome was liberated, but the rest of Italy was not.
There wasn't even a film company when they were making this?
Yeah. Really scraped together, mostly shot in, the streets. Once Upon a Time in Rome, Open City talks a lot about, like, he really wanted to just, like, film was shooting on sets, it was the studio system, and he wanted to issue that, show something real. Because he was like, during the war, all we made were movies about, like, rich women on, like, couches, smoking and having lovers.
I would watch that.
Those are the movies that M's like, this is really good. And
they are. Like, they are really good.
Yeah, no, they're really
good. I like these too. Don't get me wrong. I like both.
I like both,
This is our last year at Marion Band argument.
The thing is you last year at Marion Band isn't made in 1945 in the ruins of Rome.
No, that's why they made this movie instead.
Yeah. In the 60s, you get to make those kind of, like, navel-gazing nonsense films. It's the 60s.
That's what the 60s is all about.
Movies exist in their cult. I feel like getting into European cinema really, like, underscores the amount that movies are made in historical context, and understanding the historical context is really important.
Why?
Anyway, Jackson, what's this about?
No, I have to circle back on it. Does America not have history?
not enough. No.
Not in the same way.
I genuinely think, especially if you're looking at big, like, I think, like, New Hollywood does this really well. I think there's good stuff with, like, noir being a response to everyone coming back from the war and, like, being sad, being like, oh, the war fixed the depression, but it didn't, like, give me a job, actually. Mm-hmm. Because the, you know, a lot of the golden age of noir is, like, in the fucking late 40s, early 50s.
Right.
Looking back on, like, a time before. And it's just weird. But I genuinely, like, and then there's this, you know, the new Hollywood 60s and 70s stuff. But I really think the studios, like, the big Hollywood studio system erases a lot of the history of America told through cinema. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of like this static thing as the world is changing, which is just
I mean, this is why, like, the Lizzie Borden movies, they fucking really hit, because they're made by someone who's not working in any of that system. She's shooting for no money in grimy New York City, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when people talk about American cinema, they're talking about fucking Jaws. Jaws does not exist in a historical context. It's, like, worth considering, I don't think.
I mean, it does, but that historical context is, like, cinematic, right? It's about, when people talk about it, they're talking about the blockbuster and not about what was going on in the 70s in the seaside towns.
Yes.
Right.
Also, the politics of a mayor not wanting to close the town because of tourism is that's eternal. That's, that one doesn't need a moment.
Eternal bad American capitalism stuff, not necessarily like, oh, the specific character of mid-70s small beach town America.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think this is true of a lot of cinema outside of America. I just think European history in the last 120 years, by its nature, is most widely known, so it's easiest to, like, understand where the movies are operating within, right?
That makes sense.
Like, I feel this way when I watch, like, Japanese cinema too, because I know a little bit about Japanese history, but I think it's really easy, if you didn't know that stuff, to be kind of lost in some of the, like, context.
Yes. I mean,
everybody knows about the fucking Nazis.
Less than you think. Like, I mean, there's a lot of reviews of this movie that, like, people know the Nazis, but, like, they're don't know about Italy. No one knows what the fuck Italy were doing in the Second World War. It's just a weird thing. It doesn't, like, neatly fit into the narrative, so it's just kind of like, and then Italy was kind of allied with them. And
well, that's why don't kind you of explain it. What the movie is about?
Well, yes. So, the movie, Rome Open City, is about Rome when it is an open city occupied by the German SS.
Yes.
Which has happened towards the later part of the war when Italy as, like, a nation was kind of fucked.
Yeah, Mussolini's already been deposed, but the fascist government's still kind of in power.
It's such as it is, right? There's no government is in power.
Yes.
Like, when you're an open city, it's like the Germans are in power.
Yeah.
And, like, the Germans are cracking down because they've seen this, like, uprising in Italy as a betrayal, right? Italy was meant to be the ally, and now they're fucking useless. And so, and also, like, it's 1944. It's not going great for Germany, right? Not a
everyone,
great
like, time. People looking at the sky going, do you think the Americans are real?
Yes.
It's basically the sense of the movie. And so it's set in this atmosphere of, like, the Germans deep down know they're losing, but that doesn't actually help anyone who lives there right now, and it sucks. It sucks for everyone. It is mostly about the various impoverished citizens of Rome as they try to help Luigi Ferraris.
Yes.
Who is introduced as Manfredi, which is his
cover
at the time, a communist and resistance leader trying to escape the threat of SS leader. What is his name?
Oh, the Gestapo guy? Yeah. The
Gestapo guy, Bergman.
Yes, Major Bergman.
And so that kind of like forms, I would say, the thrust of the plot as you like kind of just swing through these communities with him. And the Germans just get tighter and tighter as they're chasing him. He's getting assistance from Don Pietro, who is the Catholic priest of this local area, who is obviously doing super cool secret resistance shit to get their noses.
He's specifically helping people get out of the city with like fake papers and moving them through monasteries, right?
Yes.
Yes. Including
he is not doing anything beyond that, but that is the thing he's doing.
Yeah, he's like facilitating a lot of resistance stuff and like sending messages to the communists, but he's not like picking up a gun, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But he is like crucial in the movement. A lot of bad stuff happens, like the Gestapo like surround the place he was staying, and then one of the ladies gets shot as her husband's being taken away. It's bad. It's bad around. Eventually, he and the priest both get caught, and Bergman spends like 20 minutes at the back half of the movie trying to make them talk and torturing them. Well, torturing him, doesn't torture the priest, and is unable to do so, and they torture him till he dies, and he does not say anything, as the Germans realize that if they have to force people to talk this much, and they don't even talk, surely we cannot be the master race. One of the Germans says this, and Bergman berates him, and they send Don Pietro to be killed the next day, who is shot by Bergman taking like the gun of that guy who refuses to shoot, as the children like whistle at the fence and walk back to the bombed out city of Rome afterwards, hoping for the Americans to come eventually, which obviously, you know, they do. It's shot knowing that the audience knows this is in the past, but is very much like, these are the sacrifices that brought us today.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how it ends.
Yep. Yeah, because of the nature of where Rome was at this time, movies shot in like scraps of film they like bought from photographers and stuff. It's on like three different film stocks when they like analyze the prints that they have. Mostly shot with non-actors. The only two actors are Anna Magnani, who plays the Pina, the pregnant lady who gets shot in the midpoint of the movie, and Aldo Fabrizi, who plays the priest. Both of them were like comedians and like stage actors. Because Rossellini was specifically like, I don't like actors. they don't bring realism, but he liked comedians.
I feel like that's not
that rings true.
Like, maybe to that extreme in this extent, but I feel that's not an uncommon opinion of comedians and actors over time.
No, I know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I heard of this movie for years and years and years. Didn't really know what it was about. Just knew it was like, you know, this is like literally the start point of neorealist cinema, a term that can strike like Italian neorealism specifically, which is a term Rossellini hated. He was like, I call them plausible films. It's not like some new thing. I just wanted movies that described reality.
Sorry, you don't get to describe. You don't get to choose how the like academics talk about your films.
Because he's like, I saw a story about this woman who got shot, like chasing after her husband who was being taken away, and I was like, let's make a movie about that. And the priest is based on a real guy who was actually doing this and was actually executed. And he's like, I just want to tell stories about real people.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I picked this because I just wanted to see it. I'd been watching those Isabella Rossellini shorts, and she talks about her dad, and I was like, I've never seen a Rossellini movie, so I might as well start with where he really broke out. This movie's fucking incredible.
Yeah, fantastic movie.
I loved it.
Yeah. I think like the focus on like the small human stories with like levity is genuinely really good. It's just funny a lot of the time. There's the bit where the priest comes into Luthen's secret enclave from Andor, basically the antique shop. And he's like waiting for them to take him in the back where the communist printing press is. And there's a saint statue and a naked lady statue. And he's like, while no one's looking, he turns them away from each other. So it's not sacrilegious that the saint is looking at boobs. It's really good.
Yeah, that stuff's really good.
There is a classic, way too world weary, European child, a staple of mid-century European cinema to me. When he's telling the priest, he's like, I don't have time for like catechism. We're fighting a class war.
Yeah, that kid is amazing.
Yeah.
Marcello, little Marcello.
Little Marcello. And the priest is like, where'd you hear that? And he's like, oh, from the guy upstairs who builds bombs. Who's also a kid. He's like a slightly older kid who's like lost his leg, like in the war.
He's like a 15-year-old boy. Yeah. Oh, all those kids were blowing my mind. Like, these kids setting bombs, like, that was wild to me.
And then, like, you're introduced to Luigi's cabaret singer, girlfriend, mistress, who comes in and she's in a dressing room full of glamorous gowns and like a fucking like lounge song is playing, and she immediately sits down and like goes to her Coke bottle, but she's out of Coke, and I'm like, this is the most cartoonish representation of like a lounge singer I've ever seen in my life.
It's really funny.
And she can only get drugs from a cartoonishly evil Nazi lady. She's out of Indiana Jones, basically.
Who comes in with little bottles
of cocaine.
She looks like a cartoon. She's very like angular and she's got the big 40s hair, and she's evil.
She's like a silent film vampire lady. Like, that's the vibe she has.
Yeah, they got her wherever they got her. She's not an actor. They got her from a really interesting casting director, because she's interesting.
Yeah, it was just that stuff was all surprising. I was not like expecting it to be most like half basically just a portrait of this like place and city, right, where there's a bunch of weird guys. It's like fucking Do the Right Thing over here.
Yes.
Do the Right Thing is Italian neorealism.
that's Brooklyn neorealism.
Exactly. But it's doing a similar thing, right? You see this community, you see the way it operates.
I think that exists in a spectrum of film history, for sure.
Yeah. You see the way it operates, you see like all the weird characters, and then a bunch of tragic stuff happens to a lot of people, and it hits. It's like, damn, this is movies. This is what the movies do.
Yeah.
And they really take a lot of advantage of the fact that Rome is actually destroyed. Like, the shot at the end, right, when you're like, that's just a destroyed city, which is not an easy thing to show in cinema in 1945, right, unless fucking Europe just got blown up,
right? It's
I always think of The Third Man for this one, because The Third Man takes place half in like bombed out buildings and like streets where there's just nothing but rubble anymore. And you can't get that unless you shoot somewhere that's just been bombed off the face of the earth.
Yep. It's real bleak.
And despite that, Third Man is a fucking cartoon film.
I need to watch Third Man. I feel it's like really Third Man would be one of my favorite movies, but I've just never watched it.
It's one of my favorite movies. It's great.
I would not say it's one of my favorite movies, but it is really good.
I like to watch it. I find it very exciting.
I haven't seen it in a long time. I should revisit it.
It's got that groovy music.
Yes.
That drunk Nazi who's just like, we're the master race. Oh,
we're all doomed.
Yeah, that guy was... I did not expect a character like that in this movie. To kind of like make the Nazis... Almost like... It almost humanized Nazis in an interesting way for me.
It's weird because he's like kind of a goofy character. He's saying the thing that you expect the audience to believe, right? Like, he's put in there to be like the one person who gets to speak up to the oppressive force, because both of our actual heroes are taciturn, quiet guys, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it has to come from someone else, and it comes from this kind of like bumbling drunkard character who's like normally like a cartoon character, but he's in this one moment saying a real thing. But he is the guy who does shoot the priest at the very end, because all the Italians won't do it. They see the kids watching and like, we can't shoot a priest, and they shoot the dirt around him, and then he walks up and shoots him in the back.
Yeah, that surprised me. I did not expect that.
I like that stuff. I thought that was very good, because like the Nazis are in like this fucking like incredible lounge bar in their little high, like headquarters that's literally like a double door away from where they're torturing guys. It's like the interrogation room has a double padded door, like fucking M's office in the Bond movies, away from the lounge where everyone's just kind of like boozing and smoking, and there's someone playing the piano at all times.
Yeah, at the end when Ferrari's is being taken away and they like come out. It was really surprising me how close they were to be able to see that. Yeah, but they just see him. They have the cabaret girl with them and she like faints when she sees him.
When the Nazi lady like just leaves her there and then picks up the like fur coat she gave her, I was like, there'll be other people to give this to.
Yeah, she's like, for next time.
Yeah.
Fuck.
Fucking great.
Yeah. Talk about bleak.
There's a bit of the Wikipedia for this. It was like, Pope Francis said this film is among his favorites. I fucking bet it is.
Yeah.
Because it's like such a like, because the movie doesn't like really like spend a lot of time dwelling on it, but so much of it is about this like united cause between the Catholic priest and the communist who, you know, explicitly is atheistic, right? This is like a big part of European communism, specifically this era. And like little kids, like, I don't have time for church. We're fighting class war. It's like all about the way in which that force is a-religious at a time when religion is like, you know, still bigger than it is these days. And those two having united cause and understanding each other, I think is like really good when they're in the prison cell and they're just like both like talking very frankly about what they're doing. And the other guy's just having a fucking flop sweat meltdown. Great. That stuff's great.
Two guys with principles that, like, know their fucking shit. And then you've got the guy with no principles just losing his goddamn mind in the face of death.
That'd be me. I'd be losing my goddamn mind.
Oh, my God. I'd be like the priest. I'd be like, Lord's with me.
No, so, I'd be chill.
I'd be chill in the face of fucking torture and death. What are you talking about? No, you wouldn't. What are you, like, were you crazy?
I mean, like, they knew that this was a possibility. So they're going to be chill about it.
I'm not saying that there haven't been many, many people in history fighting for causes that have been very chill in the face of, like, terrible situations. That is noted in history. I'm saying us three on this podcast, doing it in Skype, would not necessarily hold up to the fucking saintly rigor.
I would like to not have to find out. However,
yeah, exactly. That's one way to find out, ideal. And I don't want to be in that situation.
But I think I would be peeing and pooping.
Peeing and pooping.
I'm not saying I would hold up in the face of torture. I'm saying I just wouldn't be as, like, panicky.
I'd be panicking. I would panic. I'd panic when I lose my phone. Like, what are you, like... Like, what are you talking about? I'd be panicking.
This is the most, like, I could fight a wolf Dan Reichert thing you've ever said, Destiny, I think.
I think I would find inner peace when confronted with the end of the world. I think that's what I would do, personally.
You're doing a lot of work on that.
Ridiculous.
I'm just saying.
Uh-huh.
There are reasons to be stoic. There are reasons. Uh-huh. If you know you're right, if you know you're in the right.
It's not about the strength of your idealism. It's about the reality of being a person.
I'm not going to argue anymore.
I just think the minute they start tearing off my fingernails, I'm going to tell them whatever they want.
Oh, I feel like there's so much at stake that I would not keep my cool. They're ripping off my fingernails. I have a thing about fingernails.
I'll let them know that you've got a thing about fingernails.
and that would help me panic a little more. But yeah, no. If you know you're right. That was probably my favorite sequence when they're like trying to show Don Pietro like, ooh, look what we're doing to him. Look what your charity has done.
And I like it because like the Nazi commander guy goes into the lounge room and has a whole conversation. He comes back and like they've been torturing him while Don Pietro's watching the entire time. So Don Pietro's just like crying and sweating, but he's like he is in the exact same spot as when he left. It's really good.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved that. And then like, yeah, no, I lost my train of thought.
Because they show a little bit of, like, the torture, but it's not, like, super graphic or anything, right?
No.
It's the 1940s, and, like, the special effects, apparently they got a, like, sculptor in, and he, like, the beat-up effects were all made out of, like, bubble gum.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
How'd they get the one where like there's a bit sticking out of him that's currently on fire? That was the only one that I'm like,
I don't know.
Yeah, the
there's
way
a lot of things with yeah, but that one I'm like, you just probably had that on fire and be like, all right, let's get the shot and put it out.
Yeah.
My assumption.
They showed more of the torture than I was expecting for an old film. I was really surprised.
I mean,
but I think it knows when to like pan away and just have Don Pietro's reaction. I think that like he's the load bearing support of this movie. I think he's great.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Priest. Yeah, no, yeah, he's my favorite.
I feel like they know he's the guy. Like they have the incredible bit in the middle, like the climax of the first half where the Nazis are surrounded the big like apartment building.
Yes,
And he's got a. Get up there, stop the kid from throwing bombs off the roof, because there's literally no point at this moment. It would just make everything worse. And then get back to the room to pretend to be reading a guy his last rites.
But like, it's an old man who's like, he's like Charlie Buckhead's grandfather, but belligerent. So they have to bash him with a pan to knock him out, because otherwise he'd give them away. And then he comes down and we see Pina shot, and he like picks her up like it's the Pieta, right?
Yeah,
like the last part of that section is him holding her like it's like she's Jesus.
Yeah. Movies.
It's fucking good.
Yeah.
Cinema.
Yeah. This one just very good. Liked it quite a bit.
Yeah. Me too.
Me too.
If there's nothing else, we could get to questions.
We can get to questions.
All right.
Time for questions.
Sometimes the movie's just self-evident. What are you going to do? Jacob wrote in, Criterion recently added a 24/7 movie stream to the service. Any thoughts on that in particular or other ways streaming services have approached discoverability? I was a fan when Mubi had a single curated movie added every day that went away after a month, allowed me to read about a single film, decide if it sounded interesting, and put pressure on me to actually watch it before it left.
I like that 24/7 streaming thing, but I never watch them. Like, I have a few streaming sites. Like, Night Flight has one. Shudder has one. I never utilize them.
I think if you want a really positive response to this, listen to the next Ornate Stairwells, because I know Autumn has gone all in on this, because Autumn has higher executive dysfunction than I do. When I want to watch a movie, I just put on a movie, the movie I want to watch.
I can't decide.
I can't decide either. I also have intense autumn level executive dysfunction.
Yeah. And I stopped like having a TV on like when I'm just like around, like when I was like 12 or something. I just don't, the idea that someone just have a TV on while you're like doing something else is like totally alien to me. So these are not for me.
That is how I function. Like, yeah. I just put on music in the background. Like, I used to put on YouTube. Now I put on music.
I put on music, but I don't do the TV thing either, because even when I'm just putting on YouTube, right, I'm usually pressing play on the video when I'm sitting in front. I don't have something running constantly and then leave and then come back. I always have to, if I'm leaving, I'm pausing, right?
Okay, I think it's
a different kind of situation to just putting on the TV.
Yeah, we're also not then, Twitch people, right? This is the exact thing.
Yes. I'm generally pretty intentional when I watch something, but that means my version of fucking around is like pausing it and watching six different, getting 5 minutes into one YouTube video, is pausing, opening a tab, watching a different, you know, normal chaos stuff that I don't think a stream would fix.
I didn't really use Mubi, but I do like that idea. I mean, when Criterion announces their monthly slate, me and Destiny always go over it. And I try to flag things like, I'm interested in this thing. Like, this month, I really wanted to watch all those Lizzie Borden movies, because I think they'd had them, some of them before, and I'd missed them. And I was like, I want to make sure I watch those. And so I made those, like, my number one priority. And then I check what's leaving at the end of the month and make sure anything I'm really pressed, if I couldn't get a hold of it, or, you know, I couldn't watch it within that month, it would really bum me out. I catch those. So I try as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
Jacob's also the one who put us on to Once Upon a Time, Rome, Open City, yes. Which you two should watch. It's really good.
Yeah, I meant to before this, and because when you read to me that the movie was made while Italy was still occupied, but not Rome, I was really surprised.
There's a bit, because Rossellini had like this like intense love affair with Anna Magnani after this movie, like during this movie and for the next little while, and then left her for Ingrid Bergman. And so there's a bit of Isabella Rossellini talking about like, yeah, I mean, she was still a friend of the family, and like I met her because I was like, she's so different than my mom. What? Why this lady versus my mom? It's very good in there. Interesting stuff.
It is interesting.
Directors are all the fucking same. Yeah, I know it isn't technically true, but sometimes you hear enough stories and it just feels true.
I mean, he was the Ingmar Bergman until he died, I think, so.
Well, you got to feel bad then if you're Anna Magdalene.
I mean, she died in 73, so she died before he did, so. Because he died in 77, I think.
Okay.
Rick writes in. On a Range Touch Monthly podcast, it was posited that every film could be described as either a Star Trek movie or a horror movie. I had 20 random numbers selected, would like to know which one of each of these previous repertory screenings is a horror movie versus a Star Trek movie.
Right, I haven't actually looked at the list. I saw this question, but I haven't.
No, I'm just going to. I want everyone's gut check, and we don't have to agree. We don't have to come to a consensus. Master Commander of the Far Side of the World. That's Star Trek.
Star Trek. That one's the easiest one that's ever.
That is the most Star Trek movie.
Beyond the scope of this joke, that just is a Star Trek movie.
Yes.
Yes.
Knights of Cabiria.
Horror movie.
Woman on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown.
Star
Trek movie.
Oh, why Star Trek?
Because it's like an episode where Riker thinks he's like a Cardassian or whatever.
Yes, exactly.
The Hustler.
That is a holodeck adventure.
I think that's a horror movie.
I don't think you get the broad standing for principle. I mean, Star Trek is standing for principle stuff, but like the two guys duel thing, that's also Star Trek. Whatever, maybe it is a Star Trek movie. I don't know.
The Color of Money. That's a Star Trek movie.
That's a Star Trek movie.
Throne of Blood.
That's a Star Trek movie.
he's literally a Starfleet captain.
I guess he is. Okay.
Hey, remember for everyone, Destiny literally doesn't remember seeing Throne of Blood. We talked about this in episode 100.
That's true.
I don't believe that. I bet if you watched it, you'd be like, oh yeah, I remember this.
Is it really like cloudy and foggy in that movie?
Yes.
Okay. I do remember a little bit.
Because I know you were having like genuine insecurity, but like, oh, am I losing my memory? I don't think you are. I think you're just categorizing this badly. I think this one's in there, and you've just kind of lost track of the numbering.
I think so.
The King of Comedy, horror movie.
Horror movie.
Dolomite.
Ooh, that's horror a holiday. I think I would say Star Trek.
His Motorbike, Her Island. That's a Star Trek.
That's Star Trek.
Horror movie.
It's like not a very good Star Trek episode. It's definitely like a Voyager, Harry Kim goes on a fucking adventure and meets a girl. Bad episode from like season 3.
Yep.
And they still gave Harry Kim things to do.
Petition to get that man promoted.
Rope, Star Trek.
That is Star Trek.
Yes, that one's literally a Star Trek. Yeah.
Yeah.
Excalibur, Star Trek.
Star Trek.
Putney Swope, horror movie.
That's a horror movie.
Point Break.
That's a Star Trek.
I think that's a Star Trek. Jackson.
I said Star Trek.
Oh, I didn't hear you. M.
That's horror a horror movie.
That could be both. I think I could see an argument for Star Trek. M is basically like that DS9 episode where they go to 2035 or whatever.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm saying Star Trek because you got the whole, like, it's all about the meetings at the back half.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sold on that.
Lawrence of Arabia. That's Star Trek.
That's a Star Trek.
Malcolm X. That's also a Star Trek.
Yes.
That's also a Star Trek. Yes.
Monty Python's Life of Brian. It's a red shirts.
It's probably in this framework, it's probably a Star Trek, but I don't want
to. Derogatory, though. Extremely derogatory. The Lady from Shanghai. That's a horror movie.
Horror movie.
Last Year at Marienbad. That's a Star Trek.
Star Trek.
I guess it is a Star Trek.
The Man for All Seasons. The most Star Trek you can get.
That's extremely Star Trek.
Hella Star Trek core.
The Neon Demon. That's a horror movie.
Horror movie.
Yes. I mean, that is also actually a horror movie, kind of, but...
Hilver writes in, the hypothetical greatest film of all time cannot be an adaptation. True or false?
I believe false.
I believe false.
I understand the argument.
I do, too.
I don't agree with it, I guess.
I just think adapted scripts are just as valid as original scripts.
Exactly. Yeah, that's my stance as well.
I just think this is like a very video game brain thing to say, like, oh, this uses the medium perfectly. No adaptive screenplay could possibly use the form of cinema so well. I just don't agree with that. I think
turning a script into a film is already an adaptive layer regardless.
Yes.
Agreed.
And the original ideas of concept art and like anything, the film is about adaptive layers. There's so many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tron Rights, and I think we covered a good number of these. Anyone have particularly favorite shots in this movie?
I just liked the glowing, beat-up, Jesus-y face of Ferrari when Don Pietro looks at him. I like the shot where she takes the coat away from the girl after she faints. I think we talked about most of them already. Oh, the very last shot where you see the basilica as the kids go down the hill.
That is that shot is like, that's European cinema to me.
Me too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like easily the last shot. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, it pans down and you just see how fucked Rome is because they shot it at the right time and you're like, damn.
One of the ones I like, because it clearly had to be an accident, is when the resistance fighters are firing on the like prison convoy, there's a dog that's like running up to the convoy, and the minute all the guns go off, that dog fucking bolts.
I love a good actor dog.
That clearly,
That's a dog. That's a fucking dog.
That's not an actor dog, but I love a good dog moment in a film.
And it's just very, that whole shot is really good because it's mostly done in that big wide shot of, just on the hill behind the guys with the guns, they fire down on the convoy and you just see guys keeling over. And then like the guys jump off the truck and are running into the hills. And then there's all the Nazis, but you're like, everyone's in a dark colored coat. I'm like, who could tell anybody apart in this?
Right.
Yeah. Just pure chaos.
Yeah. Love it. All right, that's all the questions. Again, if you want to send questions, you can send them to abnormalmappingpodcast@gmail.com. They don't have to be up to the movie we're talking about. It's great if they are, but if you just want to send a random movie question, that's great too. Jackson, what are we watching next time?
Next month, we are watching the movie Deep Cover.
Oh, ooh. I've never seen this.
Me neither.
It's come recommended, you know.
Oh, you mean part where Autumn wouldn't shut up about it for like a month?
Yeah, I mean that Autumn wouldn't shut up about it for like a month. And I like a good cop movie, so why not?
Yeah.
Really, you know, you know what I like is
Lawrence Fishburne. I like Lawrence Fishburne more than most things in the world.
I like Lawrence Fishburne. I like what I assume is like a noir-y cop movie. And I like 90s cinema, so it should be a slam dunk.
Agreed.
Yeah. That's really exciting. All right, Destiny, where can people find you?
At Fridge Buzz Now, most places. And my other podcast, Battling Girls, we keep taking these little hiccups, these little breaks, but we will be back. We will be back.
Jackson.
You can find me at Headfalls Off on Twitter.com. You can find the podcast we do at AnulMapping.com.
You can find me on Twitter at EM_being. If you would like to support our podcast, you can do that at patreon.com/AnulMapping. For $1 a month, you get the Great Gundam Project. We're currently, this week, we're on break, but we're about to do some SD Gundam, and then we're going to watch Gundam Unicorn, which I know people are excited for. For $5 a month, you get Blockbusters, where we're about to watch Kingdom of Heaven. Talk about that tomorrow. That'll be out later this week. For $10, you get VoIP Life, which hasn't been about movies lately, but maybe someday it'll be about movies again. But it's just a free-form podcast where we talk about random shit. It's good. I like it a lot. It helps support the network. As always, you can retweet the pods, tell your friends about them. If you're on a social network, we're not, which is all of them but Twitter, basically. Plug the podcast. It's good. I like it. And if you like it, you should tell people that it's good.
Yeah.
We'll be back in 2 weeks. So until then, movies.
Now more than ever.
Don't expect to like them.